Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm very glad you're with me. I'd be hit with acute glomerulonephritis if I had to drink in the idea that you missed today's show. The convening world. There's a new model for convening your organization at what used to be conferences, and Opportunity Collaboration is an example. Topher Wilkins is Opportunity Collaboration's CEO. And auctions and cash calls, part deux. Auctioneer Bobby D. Ellert continues the conversation from the December 12th show last year to get you to high-performing auctions and cash calls at your events. On Tony's Take Two, Between the Guests, an e-newsletter that may interest you. We're sponsored by Generosity Series, hosting multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Topher Wilkins. He's been convening and connecting people for social change for over a decade. It started when he co-founded the Highland City Club, a membership community of 300 changemakers in Boulder, Colorado. Now he leads Opportunity Collaboration, a global network of 1,200 nonprofit leaders, for-profit social entrepreneurs, grant makers, impact investors, corporates and academics, building sustainable solutions to poverty. Topher created conveners.org, a group of over 150 fellow conveners and accelerators in the impact space. Opportunity Collaboration is on Twitter at opcoll, O-P-P-C-O-L-L. Topher, I'm glad you and I are convening in the studio.
Thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I'm glad you're with us from California.
Yeah, all the way.
Good to see you again.
Thanks.
You've been getting people together for a long time. What do you think nonprofits are not really doing so well around what is the typical conference?
Sure. I mean, typical conferences, as far as I've experienced them, tend to be pretty hierarchical, pretty stratified. There's a clear dynamic between the folks who are there to seek resources and the folks that are there to potentially offer those resources. Mm-hmm. And it creates division.
And there isn't a lot of opportunity really for what I find a lot of conferences advertise as being available, networking, time to meet each other. That's really, you're sitting at a meal, that's the most time you get, but there's a speaker, so you don't get much time to speak. There's 10 or 15 minutes in between conference sessions. That really doesn't really lead to relationship building.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. What's going on at conveners.org where it's being done smarter?
Yeah, so for conveners.org, you know, what I realized in my 4+ years of being the CEO of Opportune Collaboration, Tony, was that there are a lot of other conferences out there espousing this model of bringing people together, bound together by a common passion or purpose, and figuring out ways for those folks to, quote unquote, come outside their silos, potentially connect, potentially share ideas and resources, hopefully elevate their own individual efforts as well as the broader space. And yet in some very thick, ironic way, we, the folks who are hosting those conferences for everyone else, weren't actually coming together ourselves. So we were not practicing what we preach. In other words, we were fairly siloized.
You were in your own silos.
We were fairly competitive. We were redundant. Yeah. We weren't sharing ideas and resources. Pretty classic walk the own talk metaphor.
Okay. Yeah. So you created conveners. Yeah. Now, are non-conveners welcome there? I mean, can they learn some things?
Sure.
As
yeah.
Well?
There are some folks in the network that are called advocates. So folks who, you know, they attend a lot of conferences. They perhaps sponsor various conferences. They're interested in the sort of convening world at large, but they may not be running conferences themselves.
Okay. Yeah. And then for those who are, it's a lot more robust. Give us a sample of what's there.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, over the year and a half that we've been around, we've hosted, I think, about a dozen meetings for these fellow conveners. And the first thing we decided not to do was host another conference.
yes, more hypocrisy.
So instead, we saw the more readily available function of just tacking on meetings at our respective events. So, for example, there was a meeting of conveners at Opportune Collaboration last October. There was a meeting of conveners just recently at the Global Innovation Summit in Silicon Valley. And for each of those meetings, it's a chance for us to come together, like I said before, share ideas and best practices, potentially find ways to work together and try and elevate our individual efforts as well as the broader space.
And we're going to have plenty of time to talk about opportunity collaboration,
right?
Because I was there last year and I raved about it. I video blogged it and lots of things.
Yeah.
You and your wife are both in this space together. You're convening in lots of different levels. Jorian.
Yeah. And perhaps marriage is the deepest form of collaboration, if I could say so myself.
It is. It's deep. I don't know if it's deepest, but yeah, it's pretty damn close if it's not the.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
How did you two get into the space together?
Yeah. So, man, there's a, I'll never forget this, but so my wife is incredibly brilliant. She's a Stanford MBA grad. And before that, she was working for Bain & Company, a large management consulting firm in San Francisco. And at the end of her Stanford MBA program, Bain & Company approached her and said, hey, Jorian, you know, if you'd want to come back to Bain, we'd give you a promotion, we'd give you a big fat raise, we'd pay off your student loans.
Oh, my.
And we both, you know, we both considered the offer. And in the end, we decided that we were much better suited in terms of a fulfilling life to offer our expertise, our education, our privilege, dare I say, to try and make the world a better place. And it was right then and there that we decided not to go down the corporate route, mm-hmm. and instead sort of steer our passion and our, and hopefully our purpose towards a world of social change. And it was actually after I finished my master's degree, which is in education, not business.
From where?
From CU Boulder, okay. in Boulder, Colorado,
yes.
That we co-founded the Highland City Club together, which in essence is a for-profit social enterprise with a membership model that was focused on convening. In other words, bringing people together who otherwise wouldn't have found a place to connect and figure out ways for them to form these relationships.
And now today, you both work for Opportunity Collaboration.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. That's right.
How did that come around?
So actually, my wife and I, after founding the Highland City Club, we had a stint where we actually lived down in Mexico for about 6 months right after our first kid was born. And it was a chance to just get to know him and who we are as parents. And then
that's remarkable. Yeah. The first six months of
Let's
your first
right
child.
There.
Yeah. 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 Stop right there. Exactly. I hope I don't let something meaningful like that go by. The first 6 months of your first child, you left the U.S. and you moved to Mexico.
Correct. So we founded the Highland City Club. It was a sustainable social enterprise. And, you know, everyone was telling us as my wife was pregnant, life was going to change, right? It's a cliche sort of, you don't know what's coming next. And we actually, we took that to heart and very proactively made the change ourselves. So we hired replacements to run the city club for us, sold everything we owned, and basically drove down to this little beach town on the coast of Mexico, found a place to rent and took 6 months off, sort of a professional sabbatical, just to be with this little guy that we had birthed and figure out who we were as parents and what sort of values we want to put in place of the family.
That's incredible. That's really
it
remarkable.
It was amazing. Yeah.
That is unique that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Unique in my life.
Yeah.
Congratulations
Thank you.
That.
Thank
and,
you.
And doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thinking of it, dreaming it, and activating your will to make it happen.
It was a big leap, but the sort of soft landing was there for us.
Yeah. And then you came back, and life was still, the United States was still here. Your lives were still in place.
Yeah.
And where'd you move to?
So essentially the bank account ran dry down in Mexico. And we came back, and again, through the Stanford Business School Network, found a job running a very high-end luxury resort outside of Telluride, Colorado. My wife had an interest in hospitality, and we love staying at fancy places. So we figured, what the heck, we might as well give this a shot. We did really well professionally. It was actually ranked the number one all-inclusive luxury resort in North America while we were there.
Oh my goodness!
And we turned a profit for the first time in the resort's existence. So clearly, we're doing something right. But lo and behold, the second kid showed up while we're there, and
they had to go to
as happened with the first out of this time is Santa Cruz, California.
Not nearly as remote. I love the thread of, first of all, the two of you collaborating professionally, job after job, and convening masses of people.
That's it.
In each instance.
Yeah.
From Boulder to Telluride
and now Opportunity
Collaboration back down in Mexico.
Yeah.
Let's go out a little early for a break, Sam. And when we come back, of course, Topher and I are going to keep talking about the convening world. And we've got lots of live listener love. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals Archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Let's send them live listener love, and let's start abroad, actually, this week. Chennai, India. Jinan, China. Ni hao, India. I don't know how to say hello and welcome, but live listener love to you in India. Tokyo, Japan. Osaka, Japan. Konnichiwa. Cairo, Egypt. I don't believe we've had Cairo before. Welcome. Live listener love to you. And Seoul, South Korea. Anyo Haseyo. Coming local, Fort Lee, New Jersey, Las Vegas, Nevada, New Bern, North Carolina. Live listener love to each of you. Give Local America, we see you live tweeting. Thank you very much. And Bobby D. Ellert, we see you in the studio at KJZZ. Thank you for tweeting that picture, and you and I will be talking very shortly. More live listener love to come, in case I didn't mention you. Let's talk about the opportunity collaboration. I have a lot to say, but you're the guest, so I'm going to let you start. Try to keep my manners. Why is this so unusual, attractive to people coming back year after year? What makes this such a special unconference gathering?
Yeah, I think it starts with the people first of all, Tony. So in my mind, any good convening conference, etc., is about 80% the quality of the people that are there, and 20% sort of design in terms of the structure of the event. So in terms of the folks that are there, it's just an incredibly high caliber, influential, very collaborative group of folks, all focused on solving poverty, and they come at it from many different angles. So you've got for-profit, nonprofit, funders, practitioners, like you said earlier, corporates, academics, media folks, a host of individual actors, consultants, authors, artists, etc. And they're amazing folks. They've all had their own experience, their own passion, their own purpose for building a better world.
A big part of it, I believe, is the love of collaboration.
Correct.
They want to meet lots of other people and spend lots of time on site doing that, yeah, and getting, yeah, to know people.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me, the other 20% is probably worth talking about at this point. So, we call ourselves an unconference, first of all. So our founder, Jonathan Lewis, who I know has been on the show before, the reason why he started it this way was that he actually attended enough traditional conferences out there that he developed what he called a bug list. All the things that pissed him off around the way that most conferences are structured. Mm-hmm. And you talked about it before, Tony. I mean, it's the fact that a lot of folks come to these events to make these connections with other people, and yet it's so sporadic, it's so random, there's not a lot of attention paid on that piece, and instead you put the sage on the stage, everyone's just in auditorium-style seating, most of the folks are on their iPads or their laptops, checking up on email anyway, and then they may bump into a few people in the bathroom breaks in between. So at Opportune Collaboration, we've done away with all that. It's no plenaries, no keynotes, no PowerPoint presentations. Every session is a dialogue and a conversation, literally a circle of chairs in the room.
Yeah.
And furthermore, we put a tremendous amount of emphasis, in fact, half the day is on this sort of, how can I say this, more personal, interpersonal work that we all are going through as it relates to our more external professional work. And it's during that interpersonal leadership exploration that people truly bond in a really authentic way. They set aside their institutional affiliations, their titles, and they say, look, this is who I am. This is why I care about this stuff. This is what I'm good at. This is what I'm not so good at. This is who I am. This is my story. And people get a really authentic bond as a result of that. And then upon that authentic bond, the more professional partnerships and collaborations, i.e. the sort of traditional networking that you see at most events, is cultivated.
A lot of what you're talking about is around the colloquiums.
Correct.
So every morning, we have a colloquium that lasted, what, is it 90 minutes or 2 hours?
It's 2 hours.
2 hours.
4 days, so 8 hours total with the same group.
Yeah. 2 hours, the beginning of each day, like 8 to 10, before there's anything else available. It was like breakfast and then your colloquium for 2 hours, same group of people each 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you do, you build these relationships and it's a very safe space to share what you're, because we're all working, each of us, as you said, in coming at it from different angles and perspectives and nationalities and countries, somehow to reduce poverty, eliminate poverty.
Yeah.
But it's just these colloquiums create a really safe space. Say a little more about
that. Yeah, I'm glad to talk about that, Tony. I mean, first of all, it was originally designed by the folks at the Aspen Institute, and for anyone who's familiar with that work, they do a similar exercise in terms of bringing people together, small group conversations that are expertly moderated and curated. Typically, there's a syllabus of sort of a set of readings or videos that people view or read before they show up, sort of sets the tone for that experience. And, you know, at this point, 6 years later, after the sort of the first set of the colloquium, it's definitely morphed. It's definitely sort of evolved. And at this point, actually, it's we've got a new partner in the Opportune Collaboration. Her name is Akaya Winwood of the Rockwood Leadership Institute. And Akaya and the Rockwood Leadership Institute's focus is all around this type of exercise, bringing leaders together, helping them deal with more of that internal personal work as it relates to the external work. And with Akaya's leadership, what's happened is that the colloquium has become almost like a homeroom environment during the course of the Opportune Collaboration. Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned these bonds. It's a chance to sort of reflect the rest of the experience back with a trusted cohort. And we've even seen at this point over the years that we've done this, that these colloquium groups span beyond the on-site experience. So Some groups have taken upon themselves to schedule monthly video conference calls as a way to check back in with each other and make sure they're supporting each other in the way in the way that they did down in Mexico in October. Some folks find ways to come together in regional sort of offline space to reconnect either in subsets or as a group at large. And it's a peer group. It's a chance to really sort of feel like you're in community, you're in family, you've got a tribe now.
Yeah, very all well put. Another feature of opportunity collaboration is the time that's available for one-on-one meetings or but there's a lot of unscheduled time.
Correct.
Yeah. And and part of that can be the effect of that can be overwhelming, which is why they're having this morning colloquium to check in with and this regular group each of the 4 mornings is really so meaningful. So sort of as we're sort of ticking off features of opportunity collaboration and a smarter way of convening people.
Yeah.
Let's say a little more about all the free time that's available.
Yeah, great. It's worth clarifying here that we take over the Club Med for 5 nights for the opportunity collaboration.
There's no
outside guests. It's everyone who's there is involved in some way or shape or form in the opportunity collaboration and therefore in poverty alleviation. And throughout the four full days,
in itself is just very comforting.
Yeah,
everybody I see, whether they've got their name badge on or not, I know is part of the reason that I'm there.
That's it, and you can have a conversation with them no matter what. Yeah, so you know, in terms of the venue. You know, it's not a traditional conference center. There's no satellite hotels. There's no outside restaurants. Everyone's, I guess, incubated there for the 5 nights. Yeah. They don't have to go anywhere. So we eat together. We sleep in, you know, we sleep there. Everyone's in the ocean occasionally or playing tennis.
Oh, meetings in the ocean.
All the fun recreational activities that you would normally see at a Club Med or at the delegates' disposal while they're there. And, you know, as a result of that sort of inclusivity, if you will, that incubation of the delegate community, the free time is where we see a lot of the most amazing sort of partnerships and collaborations emerge because they're constantly interacting. People are so well taken care of. They're relaxed. You know, people wear flip-flops and bathing suits all over the place. There's no business suits. And people just have a chance to let their guard down and really sort of sink into those one-on-one connections that everyone typically craves at most conferences that I go to.
Let's deal with something quickly that I think is kind of is very short-sighted, but we're talking about poverty alleviation and we're at Club Med in Ixtapa, Mexico.
Yeah.
For the people for whom that's an obstacle, let's deal with why is that not incongruous?
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. It's definitely something we've come up against over the 6 years that we've been doing this, and for good reason. I mean, the opulence of a Club Med sits in the face of the poverty that we're trying to solve. However, with our founder, Jonathan Lewis's vision, there's a couple clear reasons why we're there. First of all, it actually happens to be one of the rare sort of all-inclusive resorts where we could bring this thing together at a cost that was acceptable. More importantly, we host it in Mexico because not only do we want to actually have a local impact in terms of the poverty that surrounds the Club Med, and we get delegates out into the community and connect them with local nonprofit leaders, et cetera. But perhaps more to the point, we want these leaders to come outside of their comfort zones a little bit. We want them to make an effort to be there. We want them to feel like this is something that they can really sort of discard their normal day-to-day selves and sink into something different. And finally, you know, with Club Med, there's an interesting relationship, actually. We've worked very closely with them to help them become more sustainable, to help them be more better stewards of the local economy. And frankly, you know, because we're there, we're one of the rare exceptions to their down season. And a lot of folks are employed because we're there. So we're creating economic development locally. We're giving delegates a chance to sort of retreat from their day to day. And in the end, it's one of the rare venues that we found that is actually conducive to this type of thing.
Another important feature of opportunity collaboration is all the support that leads up to the gathering, especially for first time attendees.
Yeah, yeah.
I know I had three conference calls. One was a one-on-one, and then two were one-on-one, and then one was a larger group.
Yeah.
Explain why that support leading up.
Sure, yeah. And this is part of our model for every delegate, Tony. So, you know, we call ourselves an unconference, and that certainly relates to the on-site experience itself, the 5 days that we're together in Ixtapa, but it also relates to the experience leading up to that on-site and the experience afterwards. And so for everyone who enrolls in the Opportunity Collaboration, we take it upon ourselves to reach out and try and have a conversation with them before they show up. And it's along the lines of, okay, what are you interested in achieving from being there? What do you need to get out of it to accelerate your mission? What ideas and resources can you contribute to the delegate community? How do we best plug you into the various tools and services that we offer? How do we connect you with folks even before you show up? And so it's a chance to, in a very high-touch way, sort of curate the networking that hopefully naturally take place there. And furthermore, as you said, for first-time delegates, we have a very robust what we call ambassador program, which is probably one of the conference calls that you had, where we work with a team of delegates who've been there at least once before to help contact and communicate with everyone who's coming for the first time to make sure that the new delegates are assimilated, if you will, into this unique collaborative culture that we create. You know, we do our part in terms of making sure delegates are taking advantage of the tools and services, the sort of the concrete mechanisms that are available to them, but it's the ambassador's job to be like a softer cultural guide for the Opportunity Collaboration.
Just for myself, some of the impacts, that there were two outstanding guests that I had.
Mm.
Lena and Nina Champreet Kaur.
Yeah, yeah.
Both of whom I had meetings with in the ocean, because meetings in the ocean and the pool are very common.
That's right. Yeah.
There's lots of meetings over meals too.
Yeah, yeah.
There's lots of scheduling going on. You know, you have to keep track of your own calendar.
Yeah.
Who you're meeting for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But yeah, I met Lena and Nina both in the ocean, and they've been on the show.
That's great.
You just recently compiled some of the impacts.
Yeah, the outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, with our founder's vision, Tony, again, Jonathan Lewis and his creation of this, the last thing he wanted to do was create another Talking Heads conference where nothing happened. Right. So in other words, if we found that we weren't having some sort of concrete impact, i.e. Lena and Nina being on your show, lots of other examples of that, we would stop doing this. We don't exist to serve our own mission. We exist to serve the mission of the delegates that are there. And we very, therefore, closely track outcomes as it results to people's experience at the Opportunity Collaboration. We do that in a number of ways. First is a pretty For most conferences, you'll see a survey after the event concludes saying, you know, how did we do, what happened, et cetera. Our survey is very short. It's about 4 questions long. One of those is exactly on this outcomes piece, sort of what has happened for you or what do you think will happen for you? And furthermore, as it relates to what I was saying before around sort of the pre-event high-touch conversations that we try and have with every delegate, we do that on the backside of the onsite experience too, so that we have one-on-one conversations with virtually everyone who's there, and we get a very clear, granular understanding of, you know, what did they see as a result of this? What connections did they make? What resources have they garnered? What contribution did they make to other delegates' organizations in their work? And in that way, we're very closely tracking those outcomes. Now, in the end, it typically falls into 2 buckets. There's the quantitative outcomes that we pretty much exist for in terms of people getting funding, people getting hired, you know, people joining people's boards, mm-hmm. Organizations actually merging together and partnering in very concrete ways. But there's also the softer side of this, which relates back to the colloquium experience. And it's the qualitative outcomes. You know, I hear time and time again that people have, quote unquote, transformative experiences because of their time at the Opportune Collaboration. And that means potentially reconfiguring your leadership style, potentially falling in love again with this work. A lot of us can suffer from burnout every once in a while. It means lifelong friendships. We've even seen a couple weddings as a result of being people being at the Opportunity Collaboration. But it's the softer side of this work and our outcomes that I love. I'm an anthropology guy, so anytime I can see those sort of the shift, if you will, in people's inner lives as it relates to the outer work. That's amazing for me.
I know that for myself, as I said, the remarkable outcomes just for me. Part of what you say is that you warn people new to Opportunity Collaboration that they'll be ruined for other conferences, right?
Yes, I'm afraid so. Look, it's a very different type of event. Let's say that.
It absolutely is, and I loved it, and I'm looking forward to going back.
We can't wait to have you there, Tony.
Just about 30 seconds left. Yeah. Tell me what you love, and maybe even bring your wife in. I don't know, but about this, the convening work that you do.
Yeah, you know, so during the second Opportune Collaboration, my wife and I have been working closely with Jonathan as the founder. We were the co-COOs at that point. Our third son was born about 2 weeks before that second event, which meant I was going down by myself. My wife was staying at home with a 2-week-old, a 2-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And I was running around like a chicken with my head cut off that first time, because it was really the first time I had stepped into my own sort of power, if you will, as a professional. Mm-hmm. And yet I took a deep breath about halfway through, stepped into the ocean, and it hit me, Tony, this work is my life's calling. And in fact, I got my dad on the phone a few minutes later. And I said, hey, Dad, I think this is why you and Mom got together 35 years ago. Like, this is it. You know, this is really it.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Topher Wilkins, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Pleasure to see you again. I know we'll be in touch. There's lots of information. All the information you need about Opportunity Collaboration is at opportunitycollaboration.net. And on Twitter, it is at OPPCOLL. Topher, thank you again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Tony's Take 2 and Auctions and Cash Calls Part 2 are both coming up. First, Generosity Series. You know them. They host multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Multi-charity means that for small and mid-size organizations, you can host an event with a bunch of other charities coming together, convening, collaborating, because none of you could host an event on your own, because you can't have something with 25 or 30 or even 50. You know, it's not enough to sustain an event. But you come together, small and mid-sized shops collaborate that way, and that's what Generosity Series does. They have a charity support team that you actually talk to and that will help you with your fundraising. Pick up the phone. That's how I like to do business. Talk to Dave Lynn. He's the COO. Tell him you're from Nonprofit Radio, please. 718-506-9777. Of course, they are also on the web, generosityseries.com. Nonprofit alumnus Jonathan Lewis, who Topher and I were just talking about, he hosts an e-newsletter on social change leadership. He's a very smart guy, and it's his thoughts about the sector. Some of the recent headlines were, are social entrepreneurs people? Are you dancing in a social change silo? Just talked about that. And My Secret is out. You can sign up for Jonathan Lewis's e-newsletter, which I get at cafeimpact.com. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 27th of January, 8th show of the year. 27th of January. No, it's the 27th of February. I made the exact same mistake last week. It's the 27th of February, and I am still in desperate need of an intern who I can blame these mistakes on. So I need that intern. Can somebody please get me someone so I can blame somebody? Bobby D. Ellert. He's with us. He's Bobby D. Ellert, BAS. He's the lead auctioneer and CEO of Call to Auction. They help plan, optimize, and conduct fundraising auctions. He's also a contract auctioneer in Phoenix, Arizona, conducting over 165 auctions a year, from automobiles to collectibles, which I don't think is a very big deal. A to C, automobiles to collectibles. I would like to see like automobiles to zebras or yarmulkes or xylophones or whiskey bottles or something like Victrolas. But right now he's only working automobiles to collectibles. He's the reigning 2014 U.S. bid calling champion. That's quite significant. And a past Arizona State Auctioneer champion and a World Automobile Auctioneer Championship finalist. Didn't quite win that one, but 2 out of 3 is very, very good. He's a second-generation auctioneer. It's in his blood. It's in his family. You'll find him at calltoauction.com. And Bobby D. Ellert is with us from the studios of KJZZ and KBAQ in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome, Bobby D.
Hey, Tony. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. What's the what's this BAS after your name?
BAS. Well, a BAS is it's a designation by the National Auctioneers Association, and what it means is that I'm a benefit auctioneer specialist, that I've been through some special training, spent a lot of time in the classroom, and have learned from the leaders in the industry to apply the latest techniques and services to raise more money for our clients.
Okay, so even though you have lots of automobiles and collectibles in your background, you do an enormous amount of work with nonprofits.
Yeah, that is my specialty, and that's my focus. That's also my passion. Just like Topher had said just before this, saying, you know, he's figured out why he's on this planet. This is why I'm on this planet. I love this. I love helping groups raise more money and changing lives.
How's your voice feeling today?
My voice is good today. I've had a long week of auctions. Sold over 1,000 cars this week. I had a big fundraising weekend last weekend. I have another big fundraising weekend coming up this weekend, and then another one next weekend. So I'm gargling my throat coat tea with lemon and honey in it, you know, constantly staying hydrated.
Okay, I use throat coat too sometimes. If I'm my throat's a little sore before a show, I use throat coat. Because I'm going to ask you to give us a sample. Are you up for that?
I am. I always am.
Okay, you know, why don't you go on for like 10 seconds or so? And because I love this stuff, it's like, why don't you just go and you know? But in case you can't hear me while you're going, you know, stop after 10 or 12 seconds or so, please.
I can do that,
Bobby D.
All right, so this is just an example, ladies and gentlemen. We're at a fundraising event, and we have a beautiful trip to New York City. All right, ladies and gentlemen, what a bit on this one. Anybody bid $2,500, $25, $3,000, now $35, and $3,500. That's going for a good cause. And $35, $4,000, $45, $5,000, thank you, $55, $6,000, and $65, $75, $85, $95, anybody else? $10,000, sold it right there, ladies and gentlemen, $10,000. Give that man a big round of applause. He just made a lot of change in the room tonight. Thank you so much.
Bobby D, I love that. Thank you very much. Although I think $10,000 is a little cheap for a trip to New York, but that's
well, aside. It was a private dinner with Tony Martinetti. So
oh, it's definitely cheap then. Oh, are you kidding? You just made it even more valuable. You're still telling me it's only $10,000. All right. No, I love that. You know, there's a lot of melody in that to me. I don't know now, but there's a lot of sort of syllables in there that aren't words, right?
No, there are words. What they are is marketing phrases.
Those are all words. What are you saying there? What are those words?
I'm saying, can you bid or would you bid? How about you bid? You know, 25, get a bid 1, get a bid 2, get a bid 3,
oh,
3 now, get a bid 4.
Okay.
Yeah, and those words build the melody, and the melody kind of turns into we're trying to put the bidders into a trance. We're trying to hypnotize them with that melody, and people get drawn into that, just like you got drawn in the last 10 seconds. That is why we chant. That's why we put those words in there and create that melody and that rhythm and that flow, because people, they become drawn into this, and they want to bid. Like, I could almost feel your hands going in the air when I was bid calling.
It is. It's melodic, as I think I said, or I was at least thinking if I didn't say it. It sounds musical to me. It's definitely melodic. All right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I love it. And you're a championship and everything. A champion? It's outstanding.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we're following up on the December 12th, 2014 show when I had Neil Bogan, Yolanda Johnson, and Tracy Dreher on, and they were talking about auctions and raffles and cash calls. And you are so passionate about this, you did a video to follow up to just give additional advice and your perspective on all three of those areas. But today you and I are just going to talk about the auctions and the cash calls. You have some advice around mobile bidding for auctions. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, mobile bidding is a new technology that's really emerged in the past few years that's come out to where when you're at a fundraising gala or a fundraising event, and everyone has the silent auction. Well, the mobile bidding, what this is that you're going to be able to bid right on your cell phone. You know, everyone has a smartphone now these days, an iPhone, a Droid. And there's these new technologies that will allow the silent auction to run on your smartphone, whether it's an app or it's on a web browser. But what this does is it allows, if you as an attendee, to bid on multiple items without having to go from item to item to item and having to write on the old-fashioned bid sheets. This allows everyone in the room to bid kind of from where they're standing. If they're in a conversation, you can bid on more than one item within just a few seconds. And it's the most important part of this is when you get to those last few minutes until the silent auction closes, everyone's able to bid on all that multitude of items, whereas the old-fashioned way with the bid sheets, you would only be able to bid on one item because everyone has these sharp elbows and nobody's going to come and bid on this item, but then you'll miss the other 10 items that you wanted to bid on because somebody else bid above you. By using these mobile bidding technologies, you're able to bid on a multitude of items. And we're finding that groups that are utilizing this, they're raising another 20 to 30% within their silent auction, and sometimes more because they're able to have more bids on their items. And that's what you want, more bids, more money, more change.
I see. And that's for that's on the silent auction side.
Yeah.
Those applications. Okay.
Yep.
Let's move to the stage and the big setting, the big room where you're on stage. There's a lot of theater involved in this if it's done right.
That's absolutely right. And in a great fundraising auction event, it is like a theater. It's a production, and we want to create that great donor experience. Once they walk into the room, you know, we want that big aha moment. But then everything that's said on stage, we want to use that to build into what the cash call or the fund a need. So, you know, the live auction is going to build into that. You know, any videos or in-person speakers that are doing the appeal, they're going to build into that.
Now, included in this theater is people who you and the organization know in advance are going to bid.
A lot of times we do know, you know, that there's prepared bidders that are ready to bid, but then a lot of times, just this past weekend, we had a gentleman in the back. He was, you know, he nobody knew who he was, but he ended up buying one of the trips for $10,000, and all of a sudden, this gentleman steps out of nowhere, and he invests in this organization and purchases a fabulous trip, and we didn't know he was there because he got bought into the auction theater that was going on. What's great about the auction is it becomes an interactive theater that everyone in the room is a part of. You may have bidders that are bidding, and they're directly involved in the auction, but then you have the rest of the audience. They're clapping along, they're encouraging, they're helping that energy build and build.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole purpose of the theater is to get more people bidding, right? I mean, you don't know all the bidders in advance.
Well, yeah, you're going to find within the live auction, you're going to see about 5 or 10% of the actual audience be participants within that, but then that auction theater engages and it excites the entire room and brings everyone together. You know, that's key, is that engagement to allow everyone to feel a part of the event.
Now, on the other side of prepared bidders, there's something called shill bidders, which are evil people. Talk about those.
Evil people. Yeah, that's kind of a naughty word in auction.
Shill bidding.
Within the last episode that you had talked about this, you know, that was brought up, and it was they were talking about having bidders that were going to bid the items up. And the events that I like to work with and the clients that I work with, this isn't necessary. We want to have as pure of an auction as possible. We want to provide a how you say, as transparent as auction as possible as well, too, because sometimes if someone finds out that they were in that room and they were bidding somebody up, then that looks bad on the organization. I would rather have a pure auction and let everyone in that room participate. And if you do prior proper planning and marketing of these items, as well as your development with your donors that are in the room, your items are going to reach the level that they need to do, but they probably will go above that as well, because once you tie the item, like an exciting experience to New York City and you're having dinner with Tony Martinetti, and then tie that to the mission and the cause, you know, that's when the big dollars come out. It's not what they're getting, but how much they're giving to make this change happen with the organization of their choice.
So those shill bidders are not real. They're not really going to buy it. They're just there to inflate the price. They're, so that's why that's
They're the artificially inflate the price. Okay. And a lot of groups think they need that. You don't need that if you're working with a professional benefit auctioneer.
Now, I watched some of your videos. You have a little technique. Maybe this is standard. This is why we're here. We're all here to learn. Where you'll award the prize to two bidders. But you do this little thing where you you have the person who donated the auction item. They're at the foot of the stage, and you pull them over and say, "Listen, can we give these to two people? Can we give this to both of these people?" And now. Is that arranged, I assume?
Sometimes it is, but then sometimes it's not.
Cool.
2 weeks ago, we had a lady that was donating her house in Rocky Point. It was a big condominium, and she got caught up in the spirit as well, too. She was like, wow, we're selling this for $2,500. You know what? I have access to this whenever I want. If we can, you know, double the money we're raising right now, let's do it again. We actually ended up selling it three times. So that's a great tip for organizations. If they can prepare that, you know, your donor that's donating an experience or a house or something like that, to ask them, you know, are we going to be able to sell this again if we reach a certain level? More times than not, the donors can say, yes, we want to raise as much money as we can. But then sometimes if the donor's in the room, they do get caught up in the auction and they're like, yeah, let's sell it again. Let's raise some more money. And the crowd loves that.
They love to be
a part of that.
Oh, the excitement where you talk to the person right at the foot of the stage and you say, yes, she'll do it. And then we got a winner here. We got a winner over there. $7,500 each. We just raised $15,000. Hey, better get a bid. Can you bid? Hey, would you bid? Could you bid? I just love it. I love it.
Tony, you're sounding great, buddy. You could be an auctioneer.
Now that I know what the heck you guys are saying, I just thought it was all nonsense syllables in between real words. Hey, would you bid? Could you bid? Hey, would you bid? Okay, it makes a lot more sense now. This is remarkable.
I love this.
Okay, let's go out a little early for a break. And Bobby D. Ellert and I are going to keep talking about auctions and cash calls part deux, including why is he Bobby D.? Why is that so important? Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag NonprofitRadio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office. Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Peter Shankman, author of Zombie Loyalists, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
More live listener love. Detroit, Michigan. Arvada, California. San Francisco, California. Sun City West, Arizona. And there's multiple masked U.S. We don't know where you are, but so if I didn't shout you out specifically, live listener love to you also. But we just can't see your city and state. Let's go abroad. First time from the United Arab Emirates. Someone's listening in Abu Dhabi. Welcome. Live listener love to you. And Give Local America, thank you very much for tweeting so actively using the hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Love it. Thank you. Okay, Bobby D, how come I can't just call you Bobby? Why do you have to be Bobby D?
Well, Bobby D, there's so many famous Bobby D's that are out there, you know, and I'm proud to be a part of them. You know, you got Robert Duvall, Robert De Niro, Robert Downey Jr. So I get to be of that high echelon of other Bobby D's.
All right, but they don't go by Bobby D though. They at least I call Bob De Niro Bobby, but you know, very few people do.
Well, there is only one Bobby D auctioneer, so okay. It's kind of a branding thing, and all my my clients and my friends, they're all asking me, okay, Bobby D, what does this D stand for? And I always go, D's for dollars. I'm going to help you raise more dollars.
Oh, my goodness. All right. I mean, I could be Tony M. I could go around Tony M or Tony. My middle name is Joseph. I could be Tony Joe. It's starting to sound like a porn star, so scrub the Tony Joe. I don't want to be Tony Joe after all. Let's move on to cash calls now, because the auction is supposed to set us up for the cash call, right? We're building enthusiasm in this event.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The live auction builds into that cash call, builds into that fund to need. It stirs the room up into a frenzy, and it really relieves a lot of tension, because most donors know why they're there. They're there to give money. And whether they give it in the silent auction, in a raffle, in the live auction, but we want to utilize all those tools of fundraising to build into this cash call. That's really key.
Okay, and explain what the cash call is, so everybody's common ground here.
All right, so the cash call, or we call the call to action or the fund a need, is an opportunity for everyone in the room to give at a level that's meaningful for them. Whether it's $1 million or a dollar, we're gonna open the giving up to everyone. And usually we'll most groups will have a specific need. Like, I'll be working with a group this weekend, and they're gonna purchase furnishings and appliances for their emergency family shelters for homeless families. And we're gonna try to furnish all 16 of these units that night. And it's about $75,000 is what we're gonna try to raise. And we're gonna start our giving at $10,000, and then we're gonna go to $5,000, and then $2,500, and then $1,500, $250, and $100. And we're gonna ask for just open donations from the floor. And that's that opportunity for those that have that want to make a larger investment. They can give at that level, or they could give at a smaller level. But everyone together collectively as a family is gonna come together to help us purchase these items to fully furnish these needed shelter apartments.
So how does this work then? You're shouting out different numbers, different giving levels. Hey, another ten. Hey, would you give that?
Well,
and then people are committing to that level, and then you move down to the next level. Is that how it works?
Well, it's a little different than that. Usually, we'll move from the live auction, which is what we call competitive bidding.
Yeah.
And then we'll have some transition, whether it's an in-person speaker or a video or a combination. But within the production and the theater of the event, we're going to transition from that competitive bidding where it's exciting, it's energetic, it's fun. So we're going to move in a little bit more somber, more serious note to where your speakers are going to talk about the impact that the organization and particularly the donors' dollars has had on their lives. And they're going to ask those in the room, donors like them, to give to family, to more families, like those on stage. And then that's where I change and Benefit Auctioneer Specialist can change that kind of that tone that we have. Instead of, being fun and flashy, we move into a little bit more inspiring and more serious mode to where, now, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard the change that your dollars can make. Would you be able to give a donation and make a contribution tonight to change lives just like this at the $10,000 level? So that's kind of how that transitions.
Oh, I see. Yeah. All right. So it becomes a little more sedate, but still enormously valuable.
Yeah, enormously valuable, and then also enormously effective, because when you you start with that and you make that transition, we call that first gift, we call that the spark that's going to start our bonfire of giving, and then what happens is you move through the levels, everyone in the room becomes a part of this collective giving, and everyone in the room gets to be a part of the change that's being made in that room at that moment, and it's very inspiring.
So you're moving from competitive bidding to collective giving.
That's absolutely
right. That's the transition from auction to cash call. Okay. Is the first bidder at that highest level, is that usually someone who's prepared?
I prefer that. And a lot of times what that lead gift, you know, they're the icebreaker, that what I call the spark. They get to leverage their donations. So a lot of times you'll have these donors that have been with an organization for many years. They want to make a big difference, and they want to make a big impact with that donation. And what happens is we can leverage that donation. So let's say a family is willing to give $10,000. If they're willing to be our lead gift, usually what will happen is will we build this big emotion, we build this big balloon, we fill it with all this air, and when we ask for $10,000 and then there's a bid card that goes up in the air at that time, everyone in the room is like, wow, okay, we are doing this. We're here to raise money. And then that momentum just continues to build and build and build.
So there is theater involved in the cash call portion too. We're at a different emotional level.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
Okay. Now we just have about 2 minutes left, Bobby D. You like to recommend pre-swiping for payment. Explain that.
Okay, so pre-swiping is... it can go along with the technology bidding platforms. There's a lot of different companies out there that provide that. What that's going to do is that's going to create a ease of donation retention after the event, to where if you just do paper, you know, and people, you hope people would check out, they're going to be able to pre-swipe their credit card beforehand, and then they'll be emailed an invoice after the fact, so they don't have to wait, especially if they just give in the cash call. They don't have to wait to check out. They can just enjoy their evening and then leave. But then if the organization doesn't do a pre-swipe, then they're going to be chasing money. They're going to be wasting a lot of time, of going after these donors that forgot to check out. And then a lot of times it goes the other way. Instead of inspiring donors, some of the donors become embarrassed that they forgot to check out. And sometimes they're like, well, I was in the heat of the moment, and I gave, and maybe that's not as much as I wanted to give. And then it actually turns them the other way. You're not bringing donors in. You're turning them away. So I highly recommend a pre-swipe at all the events that I do.
Just about a minute or so left. What is it that you love about this work, Bobby D?
I love using my talent and my passion to inspire more donors to give more than they ever thought was possible. I see myself as a cog in this wheel of fundraising. I mean, in the cog of the wheel of changing the world. And if I can inspire a donor and excite a donor and engage an entire room to give more, those dollars do equal change in people's lives. Because the more money we can raise, the more lives we can change. So by me applying this skill and this talent that I've been blessed with, I am able to directly affect so many in this world.
Bobby D. Ellert, benefit auctioneer specialist. You'll find him at calltoauction.com. Thank you very much, Bobby D.
Thank you so much, Tony, for having me on.
My pleasure. Next week, 8 areas of nonprofit excellence from the Nonprofit Coordinating Committee here in New York City. I was moved by an event I went to last year where they rate charities based on 8 very detailed and specific criteria. And we're going to talk with the executive director of Nonprofit Coordinating Committee and the woman who organizes this entire competition about what those 8 areas of nonprofit excellence are. If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff, and Sam Leibowitz is our line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, SusanChavez.com, and our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's What's not to love about nonprofit radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Amit Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.